This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance to Europeans and people of European descent, no matter where on this planet they may live, and certainly this program is important for all people. Today, this broadcast is going out to the world on September 11, 2006. That's the fifth anniversary of the catastrophic, horrible attack upon America that we now refer to as 9/11. Immediately after those attacks and in the weeks following, the President of the United States and practically every media source in America claimed that the attackers committed this dastardly deed because, quote, they hated our freedom. Is there anyone who still believes that 9/11 happened because, quote, they hated our freedom, unquote? They certainly didn't attack Switzerland or Iceland. I have read the writings of Osama bin Laden, read the interviews that he's made, saw the videos he's made, and his constant complaint against the United States of America was that America supported the criminal state of Israel and followed a policy in the Middle East that was written for Israel's strategic agenda rather than that of the United States, an agenda that was damaging to his people. That certainly was his motivation. And the fact that they would try to cover this up, as they have, even the 9/11 Commission, it's come out now, the 9/11 Commission, some of the officers purposefully tried to cover up the fact that the motivation of the hijackers was in no small part related to American policy in the Middle East and the plight of the Palestinian people from the criminal actions of Israel. So on this anniversary, we must ask, how many more Americans must die because of our support for the terrorist state of Israel? How many more Americans will die and be maimed in the Iraq war, a war for Israel and not for America? How many more trillions of dollars will these policies cost the American people? And when will the American people learn the blatant, indisputable fact that Israel is a nation whose government has launched terrorist attacks against the United States of America? Perhaps this may shock some of the new listeners to my program, but this is a fact. The Israeli government admitted such in the Levant affair, that they had their Mossad agents terroristically bomb American installations and facilities in Egypt in an attempt to blame it on the Egyptians and involve America into an unjust and horrendous war against Egypt. A war, by the way, that would have cost us many lives and many billions of dollars, in addition to the terrorist damage and the terrorist lives that would have been taken by this dastardly Israeli attack. But this attack has been covered up so adroitly by our Israeli-dominated media that most Americans don't even know about it. But isn't that evidence, clearly, of the power they have over us? And of course, in 1967, we had the same situation. I have some irrefutable proof that you can't trust America's pro-Zionist media. Let me give you an example. The Washington Post is certainly one of the leading newspapers in the United States. Probably it has the most impact on government policy of any paper in America, because it's read by every member of Congress and the entire government apparatus reads the Washington Post every day. On February 6, 2003, the Washington Post, under the headline Irrefutable, told readers in no uncertain terms, quote, after Secretary of State Colin L. Powell's presentation to the United Nations Security Council yesterday, it's hard to imagine how anyone could doubt that Iraq possesses weapons of mass destruction. Well, we all know that today that was all lies. And even back then, I was saying that it was a lie because we had hundreds of inspectors all over the country, and we were offering millions of dollars of reward. And certainly thousands of Iraqis would have to be involved in the hiding or the spiriting it away of biological or chemical nuclear weapons, tons of weapons. And anyone that would simply tell the location of these weapons would receive tens of millions of dollars and a life of ease, and yet no one came forward, no one could collect any money, obviously because there weren't any weapons. Now, this was the same mainstream media that told us to ignore the clear evidence of Israeli foreknowledge of the 9/11 attacks. And this is the same media run by Jewish extremists that never discussed the facts of Israeli terrorism against America, such as in the Lavon affair, the clear evidence of Israeli infamy in the terrorist surprise attack on the USS Liberty. It's the same media that will forever tell us the danger of Muslim extremists who have literally zero power in the American media and government, but never discuss the dangers of Jewish extremists who own or influence a predominance of America's media, from television to newspapers to magazines to movies, and they constitute the most powerful lobby and force in American politics. AIPAC, which is American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, by the way, has two of its top executives facing trial for espionage against the United States of America, another issue that doesn't seem to make the front pages very often in this country. Now, this is the same media that forever warn us of the dangers of white racism, black nationalism, what they call Islamofascism, but they never criticize powerful extremist organizations such as Chabad Lubavitch, a Jewish supremacist movement, which professes that Gentiles are like animals that have only one purpose for their existence on earth, and that is to serve the superior Jewish people, the people who have the DNA of God, while the rest of the world has nothing of the sort. This extremist organization literally has meetings and confabs in the White House of the United States of America. So if you're a new reader or listener to DavidDuke.com, keep reading the articles in this site. Use the search section that you see in the top right corner of this page. Check out our links and references. Read the original Jewish sources for yourselves, and you'll find out that every line of what you've just read or just heard by me to be irrefutable. A lot more irrefutable than the fact of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, the line given to us by the major media. Good luck in your search for truth, and today I will continue on with my audiobook of Jewish supremacism. And we are in a fascinating chapter called A Holocaust Inquiry. I don't call myself a Holocaust doubter. I don't ever say there was no, quote, Holocaust or no atrocities against Jews. But certainly this is an issue that must allow a free and open debate, because we can't come to the truth on any issue unless people are unafraid to express their opinions, whether they be researchers or scientists or historians. And the idea that David Irving is now sitting in prison for 3 years for simply uttering an opinion about an historical event of 60 years past, that's an intolerable situation. It's not freedom of speech, freedom of conscience. And one must ask the question, why must they suppress these ideas? And I think listening to this chapter, you'll understand why that is. So this chapter is not what's called Holocaust denial, which is really a very poor term. It's a term invented by our enemies. But it is an inquiry. And it does offer certain questions, and I expose you to some of the arguments of the revisionists and suggest that we should have freedom of speech on this issue for us to truly know what really occurred in the Second World War, the extent of it, the nature of it. Today, any aspect of the so-called Holocaust story cannot be questioned without fear of imprisonment. And that is a great travesty of justice. So here we go. We're going to begin by talking about the great soap story, which is one aspect of the Holocaust, and an aspect of the Holocaust which has changed over the years dramatically. The next section is the Jewish soap story. The outlandish story that the Nazis had made soap from the bodies of Jews is perhaps one of the most startling examples of the fraudulent nature of the evidence and conduct of the Nuremberg trials, and the falsehoods contained in the Holocaust story, or the popular story. During the Nuremberg trials, Ellen Smirnoff, chief counselor of justice for the USSR, declared, quote, "The same base, rationalized SS technical minds which created gas chambers and murder vans began devising such methods of the production of soap from human bodies and the tanning of human skin for industrial purposes." Allied prosecutors produced affidavits that alleged that Dr. Rudolf Spanner, head of the Danzig Institute, had called for the production of soap from the bodies of concentration camp inmates. Dr. Spanner's supposed formula for human soap was presented, Nuremberg document USSR 196. An actual soap presumed to be made from humans was submitted to the International Military Tribunal, exhibit USSR 393. Sir Hartley Shawcross, chief British prosecutor, in a summation to the court stated, "On occasion, even the bodies of their German victims were used to make good the wartime shortage of soap." Now, as part of the Nuremberg verdict, the judges stated, "Attempts were made to utilize the fat from the bodies of the victims in the commercial manufacture of soap." Now, this sensationalized allegation made headlines all over the world and is still often repeated even until this day. After the Nuremberg trials, the Jewish soap story grew with each recounting. Survivors recounted washing their bodies with Jewish soap. Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal wrote about the human soap during the Nuremberg trials. In 1946, in the Austrian Jewish community paper, Der Neue Weg, he wrote, "During the last weeks of March, the Romanian press reported an unusual piece of news. In the small Romanian city of Foltesini, 20 boxes of soap were buried in the Jewish cemetery with full ceremony and complete funeral rites. This soap had been found recently in the former German army depot. On the boxes were the initials RIF, pure Jewish fat. These boxes were destined for the Waffen-SS. The wrapping paper revealed with completely cynical objectivity that the soap was manufactured from Jewish bodies. Surprisingly, the thorough Germans forgot to describe whether the soap was produced from children, girls, men, or elderly persons." Unquote. Now, the allegation that the Nazis made soap out of Jews during the last years of the war was presented simply as a grim fact of the inhumanity of the Germans against the Jews. It was repeated in books such as William Shirer's media-touted Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, and in thousands of articles, documentaries, and even in textbooks. In Israel, there have even been Jewish funerals for bars of soap alleged to be the remains of Jews. The soap bars, wrapped in funeral shrouds, were interred according to a solemn Jewish ritual. But my friends, every article, statement, affidavit, and drama about the Germans making soap from the bodies of Jews has been shown to be patently false. After the war, the Allies initiated indictment proceedings against Dr. Rudolf Spanner. After a lengthy investigation, the prosecutor's office found no evidence that the Danzig Institute had ever made soap of human bodies, and they dropped the charges against him. And it turns out that the initials RIF that appeared on the soap in the question of this issue did not stand for pure Jewish fat, but for the official name of the government agency that distributed soap and other cleansers, Reichsdelle für Industrielle Fettversorgung, when that means simply Reich Center for Industrial Fat Provisioning. In fact, pure Jewish fat would be RJF, Rein Jüdischer Fat, not RIF. But in the historical and hysterical anti-German atmosphere at the end of the war, the Holocaust hypers would not let simple facts get in the way. When Holocaust revisionists confronted the atrocity mongers with the truth, They had to admit the soap lie or lose credibility. Jewish historian Walter LaCour, in his 1980 book, The Terrible Secret, acknowledged that the human soap story was a fantasy. Gitta Sereny, another famed Jewish historian, noted in her book, Into That Darkness, that, quote, the universally accepted story that the corpses were used to make soap and fertilizer is finally refuted by the generally very reliable Ludwigsburg Central Authority for Investigation into Nazi Crimes. Deborah Lipstadt, professor of modern Jewish history and Holocaust studies at Emory University, wrote in 1981 that, quote, the Nazis never used the bodies of Jews, or for that matter of anyone else, for the production of soap. Finally, in April 1990, the man acclaimed as the world's foremost Holocaust historian, Professor Yehuda Bayer of Israel's Hebrew University, as well as Shmuel Krakowski, archives director of Israel's famous Yad Vashem Holocaust Center, stated that the human soap stories were not true. Bauer said that camp inmates were prepared to believe any horror stories about their persecutors. In his interesting statement, Bauer blamed the whole human soap story on the Nazis. Krakowski commented that, quote, historians have concluded that soap was not made from human fat. When so many people deny the Holocaust ever happened, why give them something to use against the truth, quote. Well, just as the Jewish soap story turned out to be a gigantic falsehood, there's a wealth of information that also contradicts many of other popular beliefs. Many researchers, drawn to the contradictions and implausible scenarios in the Holocaust story, independently came up with new findings, and the body of inquiry that challenges some aspects of the Holocaust story, Holocaust revisionism, continues to uncover new evidence, even as I write or speak these lines. And I suggest you see the article, The Myth That Refuses to Die, from the Barnes Review. The Holocaust experts have counted the revisionists with invective and suppression. Just a few years ago, those who dared to question the Jewish soap story were called Nazis and haters. And even today, anyone who dares to question any part of the vast Holocaust package, its nature, numbers, policies, is condemned as a, quote, Holocaust denier, a term that will probably be trademarked and written with a capital D, just like Holocaust has come to be spelled with a capital H. To call anyone who questions aspects of the Holocaust dogma a Holocaust denier is to suggest that he's a witless or evil anti-Semitic lunatic. How could anyone deny, ask the Holocaust authorities, what, after all, everyone has seen with their own eyes, the photos and newsreels of gassings and shootings, the mounds of Jewish bodies. In reality, I discovered that no reasonable revisionist denies that large numbers of innocent people, including many Jews, died at the hands of the Germans and their allies during the Second World War. And no one denies that the Germans rounded up Jews from all over occupied Europe and put them in deplorable concentration camps. Revisionists do not deny that the Nazis committed atrocities against Jews. They do, however, contend that the number of those killed have been grossly inflated, and more importantly, they maintain that there was no central program, plan, policy, or order by the German government to exterminate all of the Jewish people. Revisionists claim that the Nazis created the camps to confine Jews because they considered them a security risk, much like the American government rounded up and incarcerated Japanese for security reasons. Revisionists argue that scientific and documentary evidence supports their position, that the proponents of Holocaust orthodoxy must ruthlessly suppress debate if the Holocaust story is to survive. And finally, they argue that there are powerful political and economic motives for the creation and perpetuation of the current Holocaust story. The next section is, to prison where the Holocaust heretics cast their books into the fire. In the 1990s, hundreds of individuals all over the Western world, including many scholars and researchers, have been harassed, intimidated, physically attacked, fired, fined, or even jailed for offering evidence that challenges sections of Holocaust orthodoxy. Professors, judges, and teachers have been fired from their jobs. Men have been denied their pensions for expressing questions about aspects of the Holocaust. Some have been fined tens of thousands of dollars merely for expressing politically incorrect opinions. Professor Robert Farrison at Francis University of Lyon, too, for example, has been fined thousands of francs for his opinions and had his face crushed and doused with acid in a brutal attack. Often such victims are well-educated, respected men who were never accused of anti-Semitism until they researched and wrote about the Holocaust. A prime example of the persecution of the Holocaust questioners is the story of historian David Irving. His books are found in almost every library in the world. Irving has written more than 30 volumes on the Second World War, published by a half a dozen of the most prominent publishers in the Western world, including the Viking Press, Harper & Row, Little Brown, Simon & Schuster, and Avon Books. The most respected historians in the world, including A.J.P. Taylor, Trevor Roper, Gordon Craig, and Stephen Ambrose, have praised some of his works. He has researched in the German State Archives for more than 30 years, as well as the U.S. National Archives, the British Public Records Office, the Government Archives of Australia, France, Italy, Canada, and even the former Soviet Secret State Archives. He was the first historian to challenge the validity of the widely heralded and later debunked Hitler diaries. In the course of his wide-ranging research, Irving has uncovered many documents that challenge parts of the orthodox story of the Holocaust. Now, while he was in Germany, Irving quoted the videotaped admission of the head curator of the Auschwitz State Museum, Dr. Franzik Piper. Piper had admitted that the facility shown to the world and to more than 40 million visitors for 40 years as a genuine Nazi-built gas chamber is not authentic. Polish communists had actually built it after the war. For simply quoting Piper's admission, the government charged Irving with, quote, defaming the memory of the dead, unquote. Although he had clear evidence proving the truth of the statements, Irving was forbidden to present it at his trial or even to call Dr. Piper as a witness. For making his statements of historical fact, the government fined him 30,000 marks. In the German state's interest, they banned him from using the German State Archives, where he had labored for more than 30 years, and to which he had donated many priceless collections of original documents. The German government has now banned him from the country. Canada, France, Austria, South Africa, Australia, and many other nations have subsequently banned him at the behest of the Jews. His publishers have been harassed and intimidated into canceling contracts. He's been physically attacked and has had lectures broken up by pipe-wielding thugs. And by the way, as a side note, which has happened since the publication of this book, David Irving is now in an Austrian jail, sentenced to 3 years for so-called Holocaust denial, for uttering his opinion about an historical event of over 60 years ago. He now sits in prison, and yet people say that people in Europe have freedom and freedom of speech and conscience and press and thought. But for uttering his historical opinion, Irving now sits in solitary confinement in prison. In Canada, at the request of the Seaman Wiesenthal Center, the authorities seized, shackled, and deported him from the country in handcuffs. The Toronto Globe and Mail asked why he had been handcuffed and then answered its own question with another. Did someone think he might use his typewriter? Unquote. With the American tradition of First Amendment rights, few realize that in the so-called free world, it is possible for an historian to be jailed simply for voicing an opinion about an historical event of 60 years ago. Speaking inside his home near the U.S. Embassy in London, Irving did an interview with a French television station, again repeating the fact that the main gas chambers shown to tourists at Auschwitz were fakes. For making this statement in his own living room in London, which completely echoed the curator of the museum's comments, he was prosecuted by the Paris courts. In France, it's illegal to challenge any of the crimes against humanity as alleged in the Nuremberg Trials Charter of 1945, even if one does so in his own home and in another country. Now, there are those who say that we should not debate aspects of the Holocaust any more than we should debate those who say the world is flat. Yet would any knowledgeable person be afraid to debate an advocate of the flat earth theory? Would he urge the passage of laws to prevent the advocate of that theory from speaking, writing, or publishing? Would he try to have his livelihood destroyed, have him fined thousands of dollars, and if that didn't work, cast him into prison? I believe in freedom of speech because I'm not afraid. I believe that my ideas are well-reasoned and I can pick up and back up my opinions with logic and evidence. In an atmosphere of free and open discussion, I fear not, for there is not a truth that I dread. What do the opponents of David Irving or of all revisionists fear? Our libraries and schools are well stocked with Orthodox Holocaust literature. Newspapers and magazines publish an endless stream of related stories. Theater and television screens light up with the drama, commentary, interviews, and images of the Holocaust. It would seem that with all this overkill, there should be little fear from the David Irvings of the world, unless, of course, his persecutors think that his evidence is convincing, his reasoning sound, and his presentation eloquent. Thus, to protect their popular version of the Holocaust, they seek to hound this man to the ends of the earth. What historical fact is so vulnerable that it must be protected by terror, by jail, or deportation? What do the opponents of David Irving and the other revisionists fear? Are the revisionist arguments so convincing that their opponents must make naked use of political oppression and prison to silence them? In this chapter, I make no statement that the Holocaust didn't occur, but I believe that only freedom of expression, debate, and really questioning can arrive at the truth of any historical phenomena. Next section is called Auschwitz, the Centerpiece of the Holocaust. The Holocaust story centers on the Auschwitz concentration camp in Poland. For years, it was presented to the world as a death camp where the Nazis gassed 3 to 4 million Jews as well as millions of non-Jews. Whatever doubts visitors might have about the enormity of the Holocaust and the veracity of the gas chamber stories are wiped away by the camp tours. 500,000 tourists each year see what is purported to be the actual gas chambers where millions of Jews were murdered. From 1945 to 1989, a plaque on the front gate proclaimed in many different languages that 4.1 million victims had died there. During a visit to the camp in June 1979, Pope John Paul II stood before this monument and blessed the 4 million victims' souls. Now, it turned out that at least 3 million of the perished were figments of imagination. Because shortly after the Pope's visit, with no fanfare or publicity, the camp historians removed the plaque and replaced it with another reflecting the new official figure, 1.2 million. For many years, the officially declared 6 million Jewish victims of the Holocaust included the 4 million supposedly killed at Auschwitz. But interestingly, when the Holocaust figure went down by about 3 million, there was no rush to correct the encyclopedias or the endless stories quoting the 6 million figure. When the experts made the Auschwitz reduction, they did something for which the revisionists have been jailed. They revised the Jewish casualty rate downward. However, they had no real choice. They had to radically lower their figures or lose credibility entirely. It was one thing to make fantastically ludicrous claims when Auschwitz was a little-visited Communist Party-controlled site in the 1950s and 60s, but with greater access came more questions. By revising the figures, the camp curators were in effect admitting that the communists and the subsequent camp museum officials had fabricated numbers and that they were just too inflated to be believable. Jewish revisionist David Cole traveled to Auschwitz in September 1992. Wearing a yarmulke, he interviewed the curator, Dr. Franzik Piper, who admitted that while the official tour guides tell the visitors the gas chamber is exactly as it was when the camp was liberated, that it's now, admittedly, a reconstruction. Now, that revelation is just one of the gaping holes in the bow of the battleship Auschwitz, the mothership of the Holocaust fleet. Cole was subsequently beaten up and his life threatened repeatedly back in the United States. In the face of mounting evidence exposing some blatant Holocaust, or Auschwitz, falsehoods, the Holocaust promoters admitted much of what people such as David Irving had been condemned for saying, interestingly. In perhaps the most authoritative and exhaustive book on Auschwitz yet published, Auschwitz 1270 to Present, by Robert Van Pelt and Deborah Dwork, it's admitted by the two Jewish Holocaust authors that the gas chamber at the main Auschwitz camp and the one shown to tourists was a fake built by Polish communists long after the war. The authors, however, allege that there were gas chambers in another Auschwitz camp. The overthrow of communism in Russia brought to light many documents that were hitherto inaccessible to Western researchers. Startling pieces of evidence have recently turned up in the Moscow State Archives. When the Soviets liberated Auschwitz, the Germans had hurriedly abandoned it, leaving behind tons of documents. Among the items recovered by the communist troops was the Auschwitz Death Register. That was a series of chronologically bound volumes of death certificates of those who had died at the camp. Now, for 45 years, these crucial documents had languished in the secret files of the KGB. Russian President Mikhail Gorbachev authorized release of the ones researchers had located, 46 bound volumes. The volumes show that doctors and other medical personnel meticulously recorded each death at Auschwitz. Now, the records included descriptions of the cause of death, which ranged from execution, generally shooting or hanging, to disease, heart attack, and similar causes. Most of the deaths were from disease. The incomplete death register volumes contain records that add up to approximately 74,000 deaths, of which approximately 30,000 were Jews. The rest were Poles, Russians, and other nationalities. Now, the death register raised immediate questions. If the authorities recorded executions by shooting or hanging, then why not those by gassing? More importantly, why had the books been kept hidden for so many years? Had the Soviets suppressed the books because they knew that they did not correlate with their official KGB versions of Auschwitz? Powerful evidence from Allied sources also conflicts with the alleged fantastic murder rate at Auschwitz. In the mid-1970s, the U.S. government released wartime aerial photographs of the Auschwitz camp. Jewish historian Raul Hilberg, in his article for Encarta Encyclopedia, writes, in 1945, the camp was photographed by Allied reconnaissance aircraft in search of industrial targets, its factories, but not its gas chambers were bombed. The United States Army Air Corps took the photographs over a lengthy period, and they are so remarkable in their clarity that vehicles and even people can be distinguished in them. Many of the photographs have been taken during the supposed height of the alleged killing. The surveillance flights took many photos at mid-morning on typical work days. Not one of the photos taken over a number of days shows huge pits or piles of human bodies or burnings, nor are there any fires suggesting their burning or smoke billowing from the chimneys of the crematoria. Thousands of tons of coke would have been needed to fuel the crematoria if the murder and cremation of millions of people had been in progress. Yet the photos show no mountains of coke, and there are no long lines of railway cars filled with the fuel. No lines of people are assembled outside the doors of the alleged Auschwitz gas chamber, and no holes appear on the very roof where allegedly Zyklon Bay was supposedly tipped in on top of the victims. Another startling piece of evidence surfaced with the release of the British Enigma secret. Using computers, the British broke the supposedly indecipherable ultra-secret code that the Germans had relied on to send communiques between the battlefront and the high command. Cracking the code helped turn the tide of the war. for the British and Allied forces knew the Germans' highly secret military plans and orders, sometimes even before the German field commanders themselves. Sir Frank H. Hensley, master of St. John's College and professor of international relations at Cambridge University, published a special appendix to Volume 2 of his magisterial, British Intelligence in the Second World War, Its Influence on Strategy and Operations. In the section entitled German Police Ciphers, Hensley reveals that during 1942 and 43, British intelligence intercepted daily coded communications for Dachau, Buchenwald, and Auschwitz, and seven other camps. Every day, each camp reported the number of people brought in, the number transferred to other camps, and the numbers who were born and those who died. It also reported executions by shooting or hanging. The returns of Auschwitz, states Hensley, the largest of the camps with 200,000 prisoners, mentioned illness as the main cause of death, but included references to shootings and hangings. There were no references in the decrypts to gassing. The numbers of dead in the decoded messages correlate with the records of the death books and the amount of coke consumed. More importantly, if gassings had been taking place, why would they not have been reported just as shootings and hangings were? Since the Germans dutifully reported executions or hangings to their superiors, and the reports were made in top secret transmissions, why would they hide the method of execution used? Interestingly enough, British intelligence also intercepted the communications of German commando forces called Einsatzgruppen that were locked in horrific partisan war in the East against the communists. In those decrypts are graphic descriptions of mass murders of Jewish partisans and groups of civilians. Now, why would those secret messages include grim accounts of the murder of civilians, but not the decrypts from Auschwitz? Again, ladies and gentlemen, this is a side note. These are all questions. And should it be legal to offer and ask questions? There's no denial here. There's simply a search for the truth and a call that people are allowed to examine and debate any and all of these issues. Well, that's it. That's the end of this section of the Holocaust and Inquiry chapter. And tomorrow we'll continue with this fascinating subject. I hope that you're enjoying this audio book. When it's completed, which will be probably at the end of this week or early next week, we will be making the book available on a downloadable version, a more compact downloadable version, which you can buy, or by CD-ROM, which you can also buy, which will play in your CD players with MP3. So this is a great opportunity for you to continue to hear this book for free and download these sections for free, but there'll be a more compact and more efficient version of the book upon its completion. I hope all of you will do your best to support the work that I'm doing here. I need your support in order to continue my work and to continue to travel the world to speak. I don't have any big Jewish backers like the other side does, and I require really on a lot of people giving whatever they can. And maybe there's somebody out there listening to this broadcast who could truly donate a significant amount of money, tens of thousands of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars, to really increase and empower this work. I know that's maybe a false hope on my part, but I hope there's somebody out there who has the means to do that. And I think there are probably many people who listen who have the means. And if you really enjoy this broadcast and if you enjoy and you're appreciative of this work, I hope that you will help empower this work to continue to go out around the world. Thanks so much, and I look forward to being with you again tomorrow.
This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.daviddukedave.com.